With me this week, highlighting a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution, is Stephen Kligowitz. Currently, Kligowitz is Executive Director of Collegiate Network, but prior to assuming this position, he served as Director of Education Programs for the Bill of Rights Institute, and he authored the essay on Republican Government for the Founders Project. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be with you again.
It's good to have you back. You start your essay with reference to the oft-told story wherein Benjamin Franklin is leaving the Constitutional Convention in September 1787. He and others have just completed the writing of what would become the U.S. Constitution, and a woman approaches him and asks what kind of government they had created. And Franklin supposedly responds, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." Now, this story is commonly recalled by two groups of people, those who want to underscore the Founding Fathers' commitment to republican government, and those who want to show that the Founding Fathers were not certain that a republican form of government would work in the United States, making it a cautionary story, if you will. Now, we want to talk about each of these ideas, but let's begin with your response to the story, which was the woman might well have responded by asking for some clarification in that the term republic was pretty vague or imprecise at that time. Tell us about that.
Well, broadly, a republic meant a country not governed by a king. The root of the word is the Latin res publica, meaning the public things. But there was no general agreement really beyond that. I mean, Madison in Federalist 10 said that a republic is a government in which there is a scheme of representation. But this was all very vague. Thomas Paine said the word republic just means the public good. It's distinguished, he said, from a despotic government, which makes the good of the sovereign or of one man the only object of government. So when the Americans got down to really the nitty-gritty of hammering out a constitution, or before that, the Articles of Confederation, they were really forced to spell out in detail what a republic was. And it only takes a look at the records of the debate at the Philadelphia Convention to see just how wide the spectrum of what a republican government was. The problem, as Adams pointed out in his Thoughts on Government, was that the possible combinations of the powers of society are capable of innumerable variations. And one great illustration of the flexibility of the term republic is found in Madison's essay, Federalist Number 39, in which he really just kind of spelled out what the delegates had created and said, well, see, it's a republic.
So it wasn't automatic that they were going to come out with a president and a two-house legislature and a Supreme Court. That all had to be worked out within the general aim of aiming at republicanism.
Exactly. So that's why I say the woman must have said to Franklin, or thought, well, we know that, Mr. Franklin, it's a republic, but what do you mean by that?
Okay. That is a given. At least there were some, if not precedents, at least historical examples of republics in the past. And you mentioned such things as the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, Greek city-states, Roman Republic. Were these serious examples? First of all, what were these examples, and were they taken seriously by the Founding Fathers?
Well, certainly Americans at the time were fascinated by the ancient world, and yes, they looked to the Israel of the Old Testament, especially New Englanders, the Roman Republic, and the Greek city-states, Athens in particular. Did these form actual models for what the Constitution became? Well, no, but these were the historical examples of republics that had existed. Of course, they did not last, and that was a key problem confronting Americans in designing a republic. How do you make it last? But yes, the ancient world certainly was very close to them. In terms of technology, in the 18th century, it was pretty much the same as it was in the ancient world. Thus, Americans felt pretty close to these people. They studied the ancient languages. That was a requirement in college to study Latin and Greek. So Americans felt very close to the ancient world, and that's really where they started when they started thinking about republics.
Okay. I mentioned earlier that Franklin, or this quip about Franklin, could be seen as a cautionary tale because people weren't sure that a republican government would work. And one of the issues was that republican government, at least if there was any consensus, it might have been that had to be built on public virtue. And there was some concern as to whether that existed, but it even got down to a matter of what we meant by public virtue, whether there was one secular version and one sacred version. Tell us about that.
Well, certainly, like the Greeks and Romans, Americans believed that government had to be concerned with virtue, the character of its citizenry. Sam Adams said that virtue was the soul of republican government. And you're right, Brian, there are two senses, at least, of the word virtue, broadly secular and sacred meanings of virtue. The root of the word virtue is the Latin vir or weir, meaning man, and indeed republican virtue often referred to the display of such so-called manly traits as courage and self-sacrifice for the common good. Virtue could also mean, though, the traditional Christian virtues. And Americans believe that if you didn't practice Christian virtue, God would punish you. Charles Carroll said once, without morals, a republic cannot subsist any length of time. Mm. And you see it abroad across the whole spectrum of America, North and South, but especially New Englanders, I think we're really searching to have the institutions of society, the schools, the government, inculcate virtue, and specifically Christian virtue, in its citizenry.
And we see that in John Adams, who was really the leading author on the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, which provides for public instruction in piety, religion, and morality.
Yes, exactly. That's a great example of what I'm talking about. Again, Massachusetts, these are New Englanders. Sam Adams, to paraphrase him, once said that a man who could not be trusted in private business certainly could not be trusted in public affairs. So it was very important that the government be permitted in the Massachusetts Constitution to establish public schools that taught piety, religion, and morality, and to tax citizenry to support Christian ministers. So yes, this is a good example of what I'm talking about.
Well, the first ingredient was virtue. The second one was probably having a well-constructed government with good institutions. How did this play out among the thinkers at the time?
Yes, virtue was a necessary but not sufficient ingredient. Americans understood that man was fallen and that power corrupts. As Madison famously said in Federalist 51, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. And Madison is just a great illustration of what to do about the machinery of government. Most people are somewhat familiar with his arguments in the Federalist Papers. His solution was to arrange the machinery of government in such a fashion so that virtue, or what he called better motives, were not relied upon. So this is what we see in the Constitution. You're going to get ambition set up against ambition so that power cannot corrupt, that no one branch can become so powerful that it will form a despotism.
And that's interesting because we just talked about how we're trying to create a republic, but then you make the point in your essay that what we really end up with is mixed government, really a mix of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy.
Right. That was the ancient model. The Greek thinker Polybius talked about mixed government. Now, in America, of course, you really, of course, don't have a monarchy and you don't want to have an aristocracy. There's some debate whether Americans had that, but certainly you didn't want to have rule by the rich. So in setting up the government, Americans produced this modified formula of a mixed government, combining the three basic parts of society, but in a modified way. The people are sovereign. They're the democracy, so they're there. They're represented. They have a role, obviously. But the aristocratic part and the monarchical part are kind of simulated through the Senate and a single executive, the single executive kind of mimicking the monarchy and the Senate, the aristocracy. But again, not to say that that means rule by the rich or a kingly executive. Americans didn't want that. But they did sort of produce this modified version of the ancient idea of a mixed government.
Okay. Now, one of the issues upon which the founding fathers may have agreed was the difficulty in dealing with factions, but they disagreed as to what would be the best plan of government to curtail the influence of factions. Explain how that worked out in the new Constitution.
Yes, the founders were obsessed with this idea. As I said before, republics in history just did not survive. And often a faction, which was generally defined as a group that sought its own interest at the expense of the public good, would amass enough political power to take away the liberty of others. So the American founders weren't naive. As I said, they were practical men. And they knew that factions or groups whose interest was opposed to that of the whole would come into existence. The ancient solution of Republican thinkers was to do away with factions by creating a uniformity of opinion among the people. But Americans said, no, we're going to get these groups. We're going to get people with their own interests. But again, I'm turning to Madison here. In the Federalist Papers, he knew this would happen, but he said, you know, we can solve this by, one, arranging the government so that ambition does counteract ambition, And also, very famously, he said that we extend the sphere. We actually make the country large, which really went against traditional Republican thinking in the ancient world and really up to Madison's own time, that held that republics had to be small to survive. But Madison said, no, make them big. You'll encompass more and more interests, and you'll have so many interests that no single one can ever come to dominate the others. So those are the solutions to the problem of faction. Set up the government, ambition to counteract ambition, and extend the sphere so that you have a large country with so many interests in it, no one can come to power.
Okay. Another lesson, since learned from history, with which the founding fathers had to deal was the idea that republics were notoriously unstable and vulnerable to decay. In fact, we all know some of the literature that came out at the time was almost pointed to the inevitability of the collapse of republics. Among the vulnerabilities that you list, for example, are immorality, corruption, greed, usurpation of power and tyranny. How did this play into their debates in the summer of 1787?
Well, again, you know, there really wasn't much discussion at Philadelphia about the virtue of the people. The Constitution is pretty hard-headed. It's kind of mundane in a lot of ways. It doesn't have any great appeals to the people to practice Republican virtue. It was generally left out of the debates. Virtue is referred to in the Federalist Papers. I mean, even Madison, who gets sort of a bad rap for just wanting to construct this very pessimistic sort of government in which ambition counteracts ambition, even he said virtue was necessary. But virtue was not focused on at the convention. It was sort of assumed. Americans assumed it. It was in the back of everyone's mind. It was encouraged since colonial times through things like sumptuary laws, which prevented people from displaying their wealth. So it was there, but it was not talked about. They were really concentrating on the machinery in Philadelphia in 1787.
Okay. I wonder, end the interview, we have a couple minutes left, by referring to two passages in your essay that I'd like to expand upon. The first is, the Constitution, and I'm quoting, is a hard-headed document forged by practical men. What did you mean by that?
Well, again, following on with what I just said, these men in Philadelphia were men of experience. They had seen in politics, in which they were almost all of them engaged, they had seen that men could do bad things, that power does corrupt. So, as I said, they didn't get to the convention and start throwing around fancy language and make broad declarations of the rights of man like you'd see in the French Revolution. They were more concerned with the machinery of government, taking man's nature. And again, I think it's a view of man's nature that man is basically good. You know, he does have some virtue, but he's fallen and tempted to do wrong, to try to seize power. So that's why I say it's a hard-headed document forged by practical men. Not very many ringing declarations in the Constitution. Simply, they were trying to construct a good government. They wanted a limited government and a government that was limited by written words on parchment. And George Washington concluded after the Constitution was written that the document provides more checks and barriers against the introduction of tyranny than any government hitherto instituted among mortals.
Okay, well, Washington liked it, but let me pick up your last phrase and have you comment on that, where you say that the American founders were aware that the eyes of the world and future generations were upon them, and they were determined to build an eternal republic founded in liberty, a shining city upon a hill as an example to all nations for all time. So I guess I need to ask you, other than George, were other people satisfied, and do you think they succeeded in that?
Well, I think among Americans, there was general satisfaction with the document. I mean, certainly after the Bill of Rights was added in the first Congress, of course, the Anti-Federalists had been upset about the Constitution. But generally, it was quickly accepted by Americans. It did become a model, certainly, I think, for the next 220 years or so up to our present day. You look at, of course, France and the revolution there. Now, when I say a model, I'm saying not just the Constitution, but the whole American independence movement and the drive for liberty. And the Constitution, I think, embodies that and preserves that liberty. So in a broad way, you can say, you know, the French Revolution was inspired by the American independence movement and the Constitution. Certainly, newly independent republics in Latin America in the 19th and 20th centuries, or in Africa, or in Eastern Europe, former members of the Soviet bloc, certainly looked to America. To the Constitution, certainly, although they didn't copy it. I mean, many of these newly independent nations adopted parliamentary systems, different from the American system. But I think, certainly, as I said before, The American model that has shown to other nations as a light on the hill has been the idea that government should be limited, and it's best limited by a written constitution. That's how liberty is preserved.
Indeed. Very good. And that's where we'll have to leave it. But let me thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Brian.
I've been speaking with Stephen Kligowitz, Executive Director of Collegiate Network, and the author of the essay on Republican Government for the Bill of Rights Institute's Founders and the Constitution series.